Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now, not just Tavis Smiley, but also Cornell West, Smiley and West, co-hosts of the weekly public radio program called, guess what, Smiley and West, Sundays at 4 on WNYC. Of course, Tavis Smiley, also the host of his PBS show, and Cornell West, the Princeton professor, and now they are co-authors of a new book that seeks to keep poverty on the agenda in the presidential campaign. It's called The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. Welcome back, both of you.
Good to be back. And I should mention, you know, Dr. West is on his way back to Union, so he's on his way back to New York City to teach.
New York City. No, that's true.
Union Theological Seminary.
He's coming back.
Brother Brian, you are the creme de la creme. I'm telling you.
You're very kind. A challenge off the bat, though. The title of the book, The Rich and the Rest of Us. Is it divisive? Is it a class war frame rather than a we're all in this together frame?
No, it's a we in, are in it together, but we have to tell the truth and we have to allow the suffering to speak. And we have so many of the voices of our precious poor brothers and sisters of all colors who have actually reached moments of catastrophe, not owing to choices they made, but the way in which the system operates. They've lost their jobs. They've lost their homes. They've lost their health care. Many middle class. So now we think about this, though, that one out of two, nearly 48% of our fellow citizens, either in poverty, part of the new poor, middle class falling into poverty, or near poverty, living on the edge of poverty, worried about it, wrestling with it.
How do you get – that's a big number. One out of two, 50%. I usually hear poverty is 15%, maybe 20% in America.
These are Census Bureau numbers, that one out of two Americans is either in or near poverty. The near word obviously is terribly important. You take the perennially poor or the persistent poor. You take the new poor, as we argue in the book, the former middle class, and the near poor. That's half of Americans who are wrestling with poverty.
And this book was inspired, I see, by a poverty tour that you took last year. Where did you go? And you've both seen American poverty before. Did you see things that were news to you?
11 states, 18 cities started on Native American reservation where we should have wound up in Memphis where King gave his life fighting for the poor and everywhere in between. Talked to black people and to brown people and to Native Americans, I said, and to white Americans and to young and to old and to military vets who've been out of work for years and they can't even find work. So we talked to Americans of all races, all colors, all creeds. What we discovered was two or three things right quick. Number one, the kind of extreme poverty that we saw, Brian, is not going to be alleviated or addressed by a slight uptick in our economy. It's just deeper than that, number one. Number two, poverty, not that it ever was, but it certainly now is no longer color-coded. Again, all kinds of Americans find themselves in poverty, number two. And number three, Americans now are beyond the embarrassment of having lost their job and their home and their 401k and their savings and their health care. Americans now, Brian, are trying to hold on to their dignity. And that's why we argue in this book that poverty in America threatens our very democracy. It is a matter of national security at this point.
Listeners, if you want to talk to Tavis Smiley and Cornell West, now's your chance. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Our lines are open, or you can post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, their new book, Together the Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. And you propose, Dr. West, what you call a new socioeconomic system based not on entitlements, but a fundamental fairness. Is that to say we have an entitlement-based system now?
Well, it's to say we have an unfair system now. You can't have a system where 1% of the population own 42% of the wealth, and the top 400 individuals have wealth equivalent to the bottom 150 million, and argue somehow that's fair. Now, we can imagine, you know, conservative brothers and sisters saying, well, it's a matter of merit. They deserve it. They work harder. They are so very smart. Say, no, we met a lot of very smart people who were poor. We've met a lot of working people who were still poor and a lot of people who really, really want to work. Mm-hmm. But the levels of unemployment are so high. Jobs announced, thousands of people applying for those jobs. So that we're not ideologues in the sense that we don't think we have some pure solution. We believe that as deep Democrats, we need to have a coming together, the best minds, the best hearts and souls to reflect on this issue
of
poverty.
So some priorities you list.
Absolutely.
Living wage jobs.
That's right.
Support for single mothers. Training for low-skill workers to lift them out of poverty. On the training, Tavis, what kind of training do you have in mind that isn't available now?
I think it's pretty clear to us that this country has lost its position as the world's leading manufacturer. You can almost pick up nothing. You can pick up, rather, almost anything these days and see on the bottom of it, on the back of it, made in China. So those manufacturing jobs have been lost. And so much of what used to drive the engine of America for those persons who didn't go to college, who weren't educated, was an opportunity to work at a manufacturing job. And I'm not an expert to say what kind of training that ought to be. One thing I do know, given that this station has a wonderful green space, is that we need to find a way to put Americans to work at the same time saving and protecting our environment. The Obama administration promised that green jobs was going to be a priority. And then they ran Van Jones out of the White House, and nobody said anything about it. And so that has not come to fruition. But there is so much weatherizing, so much that the green economy can offer us that we can do two things simultaneously: put Americans back to work and protect the environment at the same time. That's just one example of the ways you can retrain Americans.
You know, last hour, one of our guests was Glenn Hubbard, who's the dean of the Columbia University Business School, and he's a top economics advisor to the Mitt Romney campaign. Mm-hmm. And I asked him sort of the Mitt Romney poverty question, since there's that famous quote out there of Romney saying, you know, not concerned about the very rich, they have their money, not concerned about the very poor, they have their safety net, I'll repair it if it has holes. I asked him if he knew of any holes in the safety net that Governor Romney was aware of. And I want to play you about 45 seconds of his response.
Interesting.
Currently in the Department of Labor, we have a number of training programs that economists are more than a little bit skeptical of. If we replace those training programs with personal reemployment accounts, much more subsidy directed at individuals to acquire the skills they need and help them with income support, that would be a much more 21st century version of training. What we have in labor policy was designed largely in the 1930s for a world where people lost their job for a period of time and then got it right back. That's not the world we live in now. And we really need to spend the money that it takes to help every American get the skills that he or she needs to succeed.
So basically he said he's not focusing on the safety net as we usually think of it, but rather trying to pull people up with things like that. What do you think of that answer?
Yeah, it's just a glib, response, it seems to me, that we're talking about such depths of social misery. We're talking about massive numbers, millions of fellow citizens who have given up looking for work, let alone those who are working, and that's what the official statistic is when we talk about unemployment, as it were. So the real unemployment rate is about 15%. Moving to the cities, black and brown, it's 35, 40, 40%. That's depression. We're still in a kind of depression for large numbers of fellow citizens. So that I want to see a sense of urgency in the tone of our politicians, not just Republicans, who are oftentimes the conservative versions of oligarchic rule, but even the neoliberal version of oligarchic rule, the Democrats. Where is the sense of urgency? When we talk about drones, we find money.
He did say spend more on things like training.
That would be nice, but it raises the fundamental question of who the real Mitt Romney is. And this is not just a question that he has to answer for his friends on the right. It's a question he's going to have to answer for all of Americans. Who is the real Mitt Romney? Because when you say you want to spend more money on training, but the day before you said you're not concerned about the very poor, and the day before that you say that to talk about income inequality is engaging in the politics of envy, as if somebody is upset with you for what you have rather than wanting an opportunity to have their own, I'm just not sure. And again, that's what the campaign's all about, to get an understanding of who Mitt Romney really is and what he really believes.
Tavis Smiley and Cornel West, their new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. And Emmeline in Somerville, you're on WNYC. Hello, Emmeline.
Oh, hi, Brian. It's exciting to be on your show.
Thank you for calling.
I just wanted to say that last week I went to Colorado for the first time, and the thing when we arrived in Denver was the first thing you notice is the poor people everywhere, poverty-stricken people, which is really confronting for an Australian because we don't see that in our country. And coming here, it was really shocking because I live in New Jersey and, you know, it's just so different. But one experience we had, we were on our way to Colorado Springs, and we were on a major turn while we were turning onto a major road. I'm very nervous.
And, it's okay. We're all friends here.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, this veteran was on the corner, and the despair on his face. Mm-hmm. You could tell this guy, the last thing he was reduced to was to beg on that corner for money. And it broke my heart to see that. This guy, you can tell with I've traveled a lot. I've seen a lot of people who beg for a career and things like that. This guy was so genuine, it was heartbreaking. And if he's a reflection of what is going on in this country, it's mm-hmm. really sad.
Thank you for your phone call, Emmeline. I'm glad you raised that issue of military veterans. We, as you know, on this tour last summer, 11 states, 18 cities, talking to all kinds of Americans, spent time, Brian, quickly in Akron, Ohio, in a room full of military vets, most of whom had been unemployed for 1 to 4 years. And it was astounding for us. It was humbling for Dr. West and I to see these Americans, men and women, mostly white, who had served their country, put their lives on the lines to protect our freedoms, and they cannot find employment in this country. If that's how we treat our military vets, what do we say about everybody else? And for a country that, on top of that, allows women and children right now to fall faster into poverty than anybody else, for a country where the younger you are, the more likely you are to be poor, that's unacceptable.
And Emily, thank you for starting us off on the phones with that cri de coeur, really a call from the heart.
We wrote this book to defend the dignity and humanity of brothers and sisters of all colors, very much like that veteran on that corner who wants something better.
Cortez in Freehold. You're on WNYC. Hello, Cortez.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be on the show. You guys touched on education, and I feel that's very important for people who are poor, like myself, to get out of the situation they're in. I'm blessed where I'm an artist, I have a job, and I'm able, I see light at the end of the tunnel. But one of the things I've noticed in being in my situation is a lot of white people who are poor seem to be in, like, delusional in the sense that they're not poor. Mm-hmm. And then you have them voting, it seems, against their interest. And then, of course, poor black people not going to the polls. So what's the plan to get a coalition together, to get everybody together? Because if you look at this, like you're saying, as the poor, it encompasses a lot of people, and it's a strong demographic, and they don't touch on this in the campaigns.
Yeah. I want to say right quick, I know Doc may want to comment on in his own way, but we talk about this in the book, Brian. There was a Pew study that we found really fascinating, and the short end of it is that even Americans who are poor, I'm talking now about persons who were formerly in the middle class who are now poor. In terms of resources, they are poor. In terms of the poverty line, they are poor. They've lost their home. They've lost their job. They've lost their health care. They've lost their savings. They are poor. But they don't want to tell a Pew researcher that they are poor. They don't want to claim that language. Psychologically, Brian, you get that. Dr. West gets that psychologically. But it also makes another damning statement about our society, that we have so demonized the poor. We have so criminalized the poor. We have so labeled the poor and rendered them so invisible that nobody even wants to claim that label, because we see the poor as the other person. So even Americans who are poor right now don't want to own their own status. And so many Americans, having said that, are suffering in silence.
Absolutely. And I think that when Tavis and I talk about trying to preserve the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and Dorothy Day, what we have in mind is the kind of coalition our dear brother's calling for. We're talking about the trade union movement coming back stronger. We even have our dear brother Trumka now talking very critically about the agreement there in Colombia allows for free labor, for free markets and free capital, but still imposes various constraints on labor, doesn't respect the rights of workers in the way in which they ought. We're talking about women of all colors. That's what's so wonderful about the Occupy movement and the spirit of our times. Now we've got even Citigroup having internal conflict. Can you believe it? Some accountability of CEOs. 30 years ago, CEOs made $30 for every $1 for workers. Today, it's $450 or so for every worker. That is greed at the top. How do we come together? We have no panacea, but we know we got to organize, mobilize, and fight.
The book does include a list of the 10 biggest lies about poverty.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Which, Tavis, I think you were starting to get at. Name one.
That poverty is a character flaw. People are poor because of choices they've made, bad decisions, and that's just not the case. It is true, and I've talked about financial literacy at seminars for years. It is true that there are Americans who spend money they don't have to buy stuff they don't need, trying to impress folk they don't even like. There are too many people who engage in that kind of activity. But these days, so many millions of Americans who find themselves now wrestling with, struggling with poverty are not there through bad choices. They're there because of what was done to them, most often by big corporations.
Roy N. Carney, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Well, thank you for taking my call, and I'm a great admirer of all three of you gentlemen. My question is, I understand the point in question, and I guess my question is, in terms of the whole training process that your previous interviewer had mentioned, he mentioned something about training, and as we well know, this training can become sort of overseen by leaders or individuals who are to distribute this training. And the history has showed us where these individuals have taken these training programs and utilized them to their advantage and not so much to train in the masses of those who need that training. So my question to Dr. West and to Tavis is, what can we do on the grassroots level who are in the position that you so plainly describe in your book? And there's no, like you said, there's no easy answer to that. But I do realize at the time when I grew up that there were groups who had control of their communities to the point that the businesses was patronizing that particular community. And for the most part, those businesses that were led by a group, I guess I would like to say.
Thank you, Roy. It's a fascinating question. Do you need only to speak to power or also to speak to the grassroots peer-to-peer?
Oh, no, you got to speak to everybody. And you want to speak the truth to the powerful and the powerless. And part of the truth is if we had a massive investment in jobs with a living wage that allowed fellow citizens to be able to consume so that demand would increase and therefore they would have resources for various kinds of self-determination. This book is produced by Smiley Books. Tavis Smiley runs an enterprise. He is socially, politically engaged, but he runs an enterprise, but he believes in self-determination, and he has to go out and make sure he has resources for self-determination. It would be magnificent if that were more widespread, and then people could actually decide how they wanted to use their resources. Right now, resources hemorrhage at the top. That's part of the rigged character of the system in which we live.
In 10 seconds, Brian, I do want to take on on the first part of the last caller's statement about people taking these training programs and using them for their own benefit. What I thought of, and we talk about this in the text, is that there are a whole lot of people who make money off of poor people. There is money to be made off of poverty in this country. We can never lose sight of that.
We have about 3 minutes left. Let's do a little sprint through a few ideas real quick. Mm-hmm. One, you're proposing a White House summit on the eradication of poverty. Has the actual White House responded to you?
We are just on the tour now for a couple of days, and we are going to keep pushing this issue. When Barack Obama got elected the first time, as you recall, the first thing he did was sign Lilly Ledbetter. Brilliant move on his part. We say that the next president of the United States, as his first official act, ought to call a White House conference on the eradication of poverty. Let's put together a national plan. Other countries have done it. If we bring together the experts, we can create a plan that can get this country out of poverty.
We had a war on poverty in the 1960s. Poverty won.
Well, within 11 years, we went from 22% to 11%. That's tremendous impact. When it comes to our precious elderly, it was even more in terms of the impact. But what we need, you know the wonderful essay by William James, The Moral Equivalent of War. How do we use the martial spirit so we're not engaging in military war? We got enough open and secret wars right now with drones in Yemen and so forth. We need a war on poverty, a war against injustice, a war against unfairness.
Since education is such a key to fighting poverty, I'm curious if you guys are on board with the Obama, Bloomberg, Michelle Rhee, race to the top education policies. It seems to straddle the party lines.
Oh, absolutely not. Education is a right. It's not a race. We need to learn from Finland and recognize that we need to create a culture of equity and shared responsibility, not one obsessed with choice and competition that focuses on the least of these, the poorest of our children.
And last thing, this is not really related to the book, but we've been running a series for the past couple of months called End of War, and we've been asking our listeners and many of our guests whether they think people can abolish war, not just end the war in Afghanistan or this war or that war. And one of the analogies that people who say yes use, John Horgan, who wrote the book, The End of War, in which this idea is based, is that slavery used to be an acceptable institution in the human race. It no longer is. That's not to say that slavery has been completely wiped out in the world, but nobody would stand up and say this is legitimate.
Right.
That's right.
Can we get to the same point on war? He thinks we can.
When you say it's not related, respectfully, it is related. And let me try to make two connections, and I'll yield to the gentleman from Princeton. Very quickly, number one, it's about what kind of people we choose to be, what kind of nation we want to be. And we do have agency in answering those particular questions. Do we want to be a warmongering nation? Or Dr. King famously said in this city in 1967 in his Beyond Vietnam speech that the U.S. at that time was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. What kind of nation, what kind of people do we want to be? We can make the choice to not engage in the wars that we've been engaging in and into the future for that matter. Secondly, Dr. King famously said in that very speech that war is the enemy of the poor. When you spend this amount of money and this kind of time engaged in killing innocent women and children, engaged in war, the longest war in this country's history, with no exit strategy, all those resources are being wasted when they could be spent here to help poor people at home. So there is a connect.
Yes, I don't think that you can eliminate the martial spirit in human condition, insecurity, fears, and anxieties that we have, knowing that our bodies will be extinguished one day, generate deep anxiety. The question is, what do you target? I view myself as a warrior for kindness, a warrior for tenderness, a warrior for sweetness, a warrior against injustice and unfairness. The question is, how do you channel that martial spirit? Yes, we can reduce military war if we can find a venue that goes away from killing people and tries to affirm.
And it is a class issue, because throughout human history, I think it's the lower income people, and we know disproportionately people of color in this country, who actually wind up putting their lives on the line in the wars.
Always. Never changes.
We leave it there with Tavis Smiley and Cornel West. You can hear their public radio program on WNYC, Smiley and West, every Sunday afternoon at 4. Their new book is called The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. They're doing a lot of media, doing Colbert tonight, I understand. Is that right?
We are. And tomorrow night at Hunter College, our only appearance here in town.
I was just going to say, you can meet them in person. There's a lecture and book signing tomorrow night, Friday night, 6:30. That's at the K Playhouse at Hunter College. Tickets are $35, and they're available. Go to therichandtherestofus.com if you want to buy tickets to that. Therichandtherestofus.com for tomorrow night's 6:30 event at Hunter College with Cornel West and Tavis Smiley. So nice of you to see you in person.
Brian,
to come in person in our studio.
We love you and appreciate you.
Always a blessing, though, brother. Keep doing the good you do.
Thank you so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the conservative policy group known as ALEC drops its campaign for Stand Your Ground and voter ID laws, and then a survey on what babysitters get paid in our area. Parents and babysitters will be invited to call in. Stay tuned.